This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition of Planet Porky, and I want to thank you all for climbing on board the spaceship and getting into the stratosphere, which, of course, is dominated by the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me now. Leslie Ann, a very big welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. And it's speeding through the heavens, as they say.
It certainly is. I had a great response to the last podcast we did a couple of days ago. Lots of feedback, which we like from the audience. So they can get us. I'm on Mike Parry 8, and you, Miss Jones, are?
At LAJ Writer.
At LAJ Writer. Okay, great. Now, before we go any further, I want to give myself a shameless plug, if you don't mind, Leslie Ann. Because as people are listening to this, tomorrow, Saturday, I shall be performing again on Talk Radio. I've got a two-hour show, 5 to 7 in the evening. I kicked that off last week, got a very good response, terrific feedback from the audience. And so I want to invite everybody to tune in again tomorrow, Saturday, from 5 o'clock to listen to the Porkmeister, Mike Parry, on Talk Radio. I hope you may be able to tune in yourself, Leslie Ann.
Well, you know, I did last week, and it's a cracking show, Mike. Really lively, no nonsense. Tell it as it is, you know. Yeah. Anybody who misses it is missing out.
Missing out. Thank you very much, indeed. And, of course, you will be joining me on that show as and when you can, as your literary career develops. And talking about literary careers developing, I'm always sorry to hear that people have passed away and all that, but some people have extraordinary lives. And I've just read an obituary of a lady called Doreen Davis. And she's described as the matriarch of Radio 1 in its heyday, who chaired the infamous Playlist Committee and organised one of John Lennon's final interviews. Now, I think you will be able to tell us exactly which interview that was and the circumstances surrounding it.
Yes, it was in December 1980, and the interview was conducted by Radio 1's Andy Peebles in New York with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, only 2 days before John was killed. So it was the last ever interview conducted by a British broadcaster.
That's of John Lennon, absolutely incredible, because the picture is, John Lennon looks like the cover of one of his albums, if you see what I mean. He's got sort of a mullet haircut, and he's got those sort of slightly tinted glasses, looking very austere, looking straight into the camera. I'm sure there was a picture like that on one of his albums, wasn't there?
Yeah, and also that one of the pictures, I should say, from that session is in my book, my new John Lennon book upcoming. Yeah, and Andy Peebles is interviewed extensively in the book also.
Yeah.
But she was a lovely lady. I met her in 2017 for the very first and last time.
Oh, yeah.
It was at the golden reunion of Radio 1, Radio 1 at 50.
Right.
And everybody who was anybody who'd ever worked for BBC Radio 1 was there. Yeah. And she was quite sort of chair-bound, shall I say, at this time. So she was a large lady, you know, not very mobile, and she was seated at a table in the middle of the venue.
Yes.
And she was holding court. Everybody was coming up to pay homage to Doreen.
Yeah.
So, well, God rest her soul.
Yeah, she was in charge of Radio 1, really at the start and height of its fame. There's a picture of her here with Diddy David Hamilton, Tony Blackburn, Noel Edmonds, Dave Lee Travis, and I can't see who the last one is. But clearly, you know, she must have been a massive figure within the developing world of rock music radio.
Well, because Radio 1 was so huge at that time.
It was, yeah.
And the disc jockeys who were on Top of the Pops week after week, they were as big stars as were the pop stars.
They were. I know. You're absolutely right. When they appeared on Top of the Pops, I mean, all those screaming girls were screaming after them as well as the rock stars who were on stage, weren't they?
And, of course, you had the Radio 1 roadshow. The summer roadshow that used to go around all the seaside resorts.
Yeah.
And the DJs would appear at those as well. So Radio 1 was a really big force in those days, less so now, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. How old would I have been? Mid-60s, I've been about 10 or 11, right? And so that went on till about 1970. But the envy with which I used to listen to those Radio 1 road shows, all you did was you were longing to be in Torquay or Bridlington, you know, or somewhere in South Wales, you know what I mean? Because you could just...
Weston-super-Mare, that was one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always listened to that, yeah, that word, that name of that town with fascination, because I couldn't imagine such a place with a name like that.
Right, Weston-super-Mare. But, you know, all you could hear coming out the radio was not just music, but fun and laughter and sunshine and all that kind of stuff. So I totally agree. The Radio 1 Roadshow really was quite something. Now, I know we sometimes get a bit Beatles-centric. That's because of me, because I love the Beatles. And you've, of course, written a book on John Lennon. But we can't ignore the fact that it's rather a special anniversary today of the death of the man who made the Beatles.
Well, Brian Epstein unbelievably died 53 years ago today at the age of 32.
That's incredible, 32 years of age. And did we ever find out exactly what the circumstances were surrounding his death? I mean, I think it's accepted he committed suicide, didn't he?
No, I don't think so. The consensus seems to be, that it was an accidental overdose. He was depressed because the Beatles had played their last gig at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. Yeah. They were going to be studio-centric now. They weren't going to go on the road anymore.
Yeah.
And it's thought that he believed his role was now pointless. You know, he didn't have a band to manage anymore because George Martin was doing all the work in the studio.
Yeah.
And what really was the point of him? And he had a very complicated private life as well, and favoured sort of a nocturnal activity that was dangerous to his life, and was living a double life really, and probably thought in the end that he couldn't go on. But it seems to be thought that he didn't deliberately take an overdose, that it was accidental.
Okay, because one version I've read is that everything you've just said all got on top of him, and then he threw a weekend house party somewhere in the home counties. You know, they all had houses, didn't they? Like Keith Richards had Redwood or whatever it was called. And apparently, because none of the Beatles were going to show up, nobody came. Literally, you know, if John, Paul, George and Ringo weren't going to be there, what was the point of going to see Brian Epstein? So that's what I read. I read a version that nobody came to this Sunday lunchtime party at his house. He got very depressed. He went back to London and then committed suicide. That's a version I've read. The nocturnal nightlife you're talking about is that he was homosexual and he used to go and solicit guardsmen, allegedly, you know, off-duty soldiers and that kind of stuff, mixed with a feverish desire to gamble, in which sometimes he'd wake up with £20,000 on his bedside table and tell his personal assistant to put it in the safe. He was a complicated guy.
Oh, yeah, very much so. But look, he was young, wasn't he? 32.
I know.
I mean, we always have an impression of Brian Epstein that he was a middle-aged man in some ways, because he dressed like one.
Yes.
He looked like one. He didn't seem of the same generation as his boys,
yes,
as he
right.
referred to the Beatles.
Yeah.
But actually, he was young and impressionable himself. Mm. It's a terribly sad story.
It was a terribly sad story. And I think I'm also right in saying that the White Album was a tribute to him. They didn't have any colour on it, a tribute to Brian Epstein, who actually, I'm told, you'll know better than this, he actually wanted the White Album to be the cover of Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? I mean, look, who really knows unless they get it from the horse's mouth? There are all kinds of theories, aren't there, kicking around.
Sure, but anyway, there we go. Right, okay, now then, your good friend Ms Liz Jones, as opposed to Leslie Ann Jones, she, of course, writes a column in You Magazine, which is part of the Mail on Sunday every Sunday. A fascinating column. I've read it for years because it is so openly honest about her life, you know, the ups and downs, the heartaches, the bankruptcies and all that kind of stuff. But I was really fascinated to read this week that she reflected back on her days as editor of a magazine called Marie Claire And everything she talked about just reflected the Devil Wears Prada film, which, of course, was based on Anna, what's her name? Wasn't it? Anna Wintour, yeah?
Anna Wintour, or Nuclear Wintour, as she was known in during her editorship of Vogue, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Liz is talking about having a car at hand for 3 years, the soles of her very expensive Blanco shoes, or whatever they're called.
Manalo Blahnik, darling.
Manalo Blahnik, thank you very much indeed. Never actually touched the pavements of London because she was ferried everywhere in a chauffeur-driven limo.
Oh, we always called those taxi shoes, for that reason, because they weren't allowed to touch pavements,
Oh, God, that's right. And everywhere she went, she was feted. Champagne was unavailable all the time. If she flew to New York to a fashion show, she went on a business class-only flight. Do you remember those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because you didn't want the riffraff down the back of the plane.
No, that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And she said one, another reason that she went on the business-only flight was it's the only airline that had a women's-only loo that men couldn't use, because obviously very particular about things like that. But, all the diva-ish sort of behaviour, she, and of course, years later, she now reflects when she's standing at a bus stop, whatever happened to the chauffeur-driven limo. But there was an age, wasn't there, when those magazine editors were incredibly powerful because they were selling huge numbers of papers. At the other end of the scale, to Marie Claire, the Loaded magazine, which was a lad's mag, it was incredibly popular. It was selling like, millions of copies a month.
And not only that, the advertising budget that they commanded and sort of oversaw, because everybody, all the main labels clamoured to advertise in those publications.
Yeah.
So they were worth a lot of money to these people. And they were, as you rightly say, fated and fawned over. I thought the best line in that piece was, "I refused to pluck my own nostrils."
That's right. Yes.
I mean, she was laughing at herself really now. Yeah. Like, for God's sake, you wouldn't actually want somebody else plucking your nostrils, would you? But you get caught up in that whole era and aura of who you are and what you represent, and it does go to your head. And she's quite openly admitting that she was a bit of a cow back then.
Yes. Well, I mean, as I say, I'm so totally fascinated by her diaries. I'm definitely going to get the back copies and read them through. They're so fascinating because she tells it all so openly and so honestly. But she's also, although you say she was a bit of a diva and all that kind of stuff, she has illustrated in the past how generous she always was to her staff, how she would give them all the expensive presents that came in and give them bonuses and give them days off on their birthday and all that. And in the end, everybody turned round and knifed her in the back and she was out.
Oh, they did. Well, this is what happens. But we used to have, when I was on the Daily Mail and, the female department, which I never quite understood why they needed separate bits of the newspaper for women to read, but that's another story. Yeah. We had a cupboard in the female office where all the freebies went, all the beauty stuff, all the clothes that were used on fashion shoots, the shoes, the makeup, all of that.
Yeah.
And you could just go in the cupboard and help yourself to, goodies.
Yeah, and then, like if they were shoes or something like that, would you then put them back and somebody else could use them or something like that?
Well, none of the shoes ever fitted me.
Oh, right. You got
so
big,
I never had the shoes, but no, I have got tiny feet, actually, the opposite. But models tend to have large feet.
Oh, okay.
They tend to be tall.
Right.
So, no, the shoes were no good to me. But, I had my fair share of cosmetics.
Yeah, good. Loaded magazine, that was edited by a bloke called James Brown. And years later, I employed James at TalkSport Radio, where I was the program director. And, I mean, you'd sit and have a drink with them. It's such a fascinating subject. It was a drug-driven industry. Literally, these guys would be driving around in limos at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to find some more drugs after taking them all night with somebody else. You know what I mean? It was absolutely fueled on that. Ill-discipline, drunkenness, people disappearing for days on end. And yet they were selling millions and millions of copies of their magazines and making huge money. I have very recently been working with a guy called Danny Kelly, and Danny was the editor of NME. So he was literally one of the most powerful men in the world of show business because every agent, every group wanted to be on the front of NME.
Yeah, but look at that. None of those music magazines, which were so popular, none of them exists anymore.
They don't.
It was a small window and it went to everybody's head.
Yes, it did.
They were powerful. NME, The Melody Maker, Sounds, you know, selling millions of copies a week. But then the tabloid newspapers kicked in with their own rock and pop writers and their own music and entertainment coverage.
Yes.
And that became huge in the late 70s into the early 90s, really.
Yeah.
At which point those papers faded away.
Yeah, I mean, and some of that you're talking about was pioneered by John Blake, wasn't it?
Oh, definitely.
You know, he had a column, and I think it was in the Evening News, which was then bought over by The Sun, and all of a sudden John went to be, you know, the most influential pop rock writer columnist in Fleet Street, didn't he?
He was the most highly paid. He was given a Porsche. You know, he hung with the stars. Yeah. I still know John. He's a lovely, lovely guy. And the great gift of John was that he was able to write about artists and send them up in so many ways, but remain friends with them. He was always welcome at the parties because he's a charming man.
Yeah, I agree. John went into publishing, of course, Blake Publishing, and I went to see him before the 2000 and I think it was 10 World Cup. It might have been 6. No, it was 2010, that's right, which was South Africa. And I did a deal with him to write a book about Wayne Rooney called Rooney Tunes, okay? And it was a very light-hearted book about Wayne Rooney, how much money he was going to make, how brilliant he was at such a young age. It was full of cartoons. It was more like a sort of Rooney annual, you know what I mean? And John gave me 10 grand as an advance for it. And guess what? Rooney broke his toe and never started the World Cup competition. And
in
the book just disappeared. And also, it was England's worst ever sort of finals appearance. They got knocked out by the Germans, of course. And they came home with their heads hanging, literally. They went out through the back entrance of the airport they landed at, which was, I think was Luton. And it was a hopeless venture, and the book just disappeared. But, you know, John is due. I got the advance and all that kind of stuff, so
I was going to ask you, did he have to pay it back?
No, I didn't. No, he never asked for it back. Honestly, it was, you know.
Oh, result. You got the money, you didn't have to do the work.
Oh, no, I did the work. I did the book. It's just that it just flopped completely in sales.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant that it didn't go ahead.
No. I did the book, but it flopped because Rooney was, you know, he'd just done himself in and he wasn't able to contribute to the tournament. England went out. But anyway, there we are. Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about, Miss Jones. French in topless bus stop. French ministers have insisted topless sunbathing is a basic liberty after police told three women to cover up. The cops in Saint-Marie-le-Mer, 70 miles south of Montpellier, acted after a holidaymaker complained. Now, I tell you this, if I was on a beach and I saw a woman parading around topless, much to maybe your puzzlement, I would complain. I think it's offensive.
Why?
Well, because I feel embarrassed and I wouldn't know where to look, and I don't think that I should be looking at a semi-naked woman in a public place.
Let me ask you, do you go topless on the beach?
Yes, I do, but I don't have women's breasts. Well,
okay. Well, look, you have nipples, okay? Yeah. You have nipples, women have nipples. Breasts are not sex objects. They are vessels for feeding babies. In other cultures where women have, topless, tribal cultures, they are desensitized to breasts. They don't think anything of it. Mm. Breasts are not sexual objects in those cultures. It's men who have done the sexualizing of breasts.
Yeah.
And so men can feel embarrassed about women not covering up. As far as I'm concerned, everybody get them out.
Well, yeah, but you see, you say that, but I mean, our culture has now developed where women's breasts should be covered up. That's why, for instance, there was a 50-year debate and row about page 3 in the newspapers because women were appearing topless, which, of course, they don't do in the streets. And they don't.
Yeah, but they don't. That got banned. We don't have page. Well, they have page 3, but the women have got bras on.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. So that's why I'm saying that it's not acceptable to have bare-breasted women in our society.
Well, I feel differently about it. I think if women want to bear their breasts, go ahead and bear them. I feel that breastfeeding in public is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that men, as I said, having done the sexualizing of breasts, need to get a grip and just accept what their sex has done.
Mm. Well, I still feel uncomfortable about it. I was invited to a party once at the bloke who invited me ran a pub, and it was his birthday, so he was closing the pub for the day and just opening to his friends, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And there were tables outside, trestle tables. Anyway, I got there, and this guy thought he was a bit of a lad, and it was mostly male do. But to make us all feel better, he thought, he had a load of topless barmaids, okay, serving the drinks and the food and everything. And I had to go. I felt embarrassed for the poor girls who were being paid to flaunt their breasts for the titillation of, you know, grubby men who were sitting there. So I couldn't stay.
Titillation, very good. One of the best pubs I ever went into advertised topless bar staff. And you went inside and all the bar staff were men.
Men, yeah.
Which I thought was very funny.
A very funny joke indeed. Anyway, we'll have to agree to differ on that one, Miss Jones, because, you know, women's liver and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's not...
Women's liver, listen to you. So I'll keep my top on then next time we go out for dinner.
Well, you've never taken it off yet, so please, you know, we don't need a debut performance. Now, if I said to you that today Sean Connery is 90 years of age, I cannot imagine James Bond being 90. I just can't get it into my head.
Well, 90 is the new 60.
Cool.
Okay. Our lifespans have increased, and so too have our active years. Mm. So, you know, back in the day, Robert Kennedy, was it, talked decades ago about not adding more years to life, but adding more life to years. Yeah. And I think Sean Connery is a prime example of that. Mm. We don't think of him as an old man, do we?
Well, I haven't seen him lately, but I think, you know, just, I tell you what shocked me, I never realised until a few years ago that Sean Connery was bald, and all the films he made, he had a toupee on. You know, I just thought he was naturally looked like he did. Have you had any dealings with Sean Connery?
No, I haven't. My dad was a big fan.
Yeah,
saw him as a bit of a role model.
Yeah,
you know, but I think this thing about if we maintain our obsession with extending life at all costs, our society will eventually come to resemble a global nursing home.
Yeah, it
will. So it's not about finding ways of living for as long as possible, but it's finding ways of living healthily and well. Mm. And he seems to be a very good example of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there's been question marks over the years about his nationalism. I mean, he lives in the Bahamas, but is always banging the drum for Scottish nationalism and all that kind of stuff. You know, he doesn't pay taxes in this country that I know of, and that's why he lives where he is. But anyway, live and let live. That's a pun, of course, on Live and Let Die, which was a Bond title starring his successor, Roger Moore. Talking about elderly people, by the way, it's an interesting one, this, Leslie Ann. You know, every day now we're seeing pleas for people to go back to work because the cities are empty. London in particular, I've been into London two or three times this week. It's deserted, honestly. It's pitiful. And I had this theory that the way the economy could be saved could be the grey pound. Because when I do go into pubs and restaurants, they are full of elderly people who are spending their savings. And I think that's one way we're going to revive the economy, to encourage them to get out and empty their wallets.
Depends on what time of day. I mean, I've got quite a number of friends who would be classed as elderly, I guess. People in their 70s and 80s, you know, a lot of musicians, people I used to work with in the music industry and so on.
Yeah.
The problem they have with going out is that they get tired sort of later in the day. So they're not people who can go out in the evening.
No.
So I think that the lunchtime economy needs to be encouraged. Lunchtime and early afternoon. My friends are always very willing to meet for lunch or for a glass of wine at about 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
But come about 7 o'clock, they want to be going home and putting their feet up.
Yeah. No.
So I think the daytime leisure industry should be encouraged.
I think this is a great idea you've come up with, you see, because you're absolutely right. When I've been to a couple of sort of pub stroke restaurants this week, and you're absolutely right, full of people of what I'd call the grey pound. But then you're right, actually, about 3 or 4 o'clock, the place suddenly empties, you know what I mean? And then there's a lull until the sort of the young and mobile come in at 7 o'clock and get it all going again. But no, I totally agree with that. Talking about going out and eating, by the way, I've just seen a survey. It says stand up, number who spend too long sitting leaps by 22%. And what it's talking about, Leslie Ann, and you will be a prime victim of this, is the amount of time, extra time, people have been spending sitting down during lockdown from the very nature of the fact that they've got to work from home and are not able to get up and move about.
Well, I sit down for a living. I'm a writer. So, you know, I do what I do anyway. Mm. My working life hasn't really changed. But I have two flights of stairs in my house.
Yes.
And I run up and down the two flights of stairs up to 40 times every day.
Really?
I have a large garden. I walk around the garden. I walk around the park. Mm. So I think everybody has to take responsibility for their own activity and, you know, staying mobile. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Evidence shows that sitting for too long begins to increase the risk of heart attacks, strokes and early death. So we don't want any of that. But it does say that overlong is anything over 4.5 hours a day. I bet there's many days in the last 18 months when you've been writing books and doing documentaries when you will have spent a lot more than 4.5 hours a day in a seat.
Yeah, but you have to get up every hour and you have to go down. I don't have tea-making facilities in my office, for example, which is on the first floor. I make myself go down to the kitchen every hour, on the hour, get a glass of water, cup of tea, walk up and down the stairs. You know, you've got to move around every hour. Otherwise, you're going to start to seize up.
Yeah, no.
So I'm very conscious of that, actually. Yeah. But I think all these people who've been couch potatoes throughout lockdown, just lying on sofas in front of the television, they ought to be getting outside and running around the park.
I think you're absolutely right.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Leslie Ann, you've been telling us how mobile you are in your working day, and that, of course, I don't dispute at all. If I told you, by the way, this is nothing to do with what I've just said. If I told you that on this day in 55 BC, Julius Caesar landed in Kent, and that was the first Roman invasion, I could then ask you the question, so what did the Romans do for us? What did they?
Roads.
Roads? Oh, I see.
Yeah, roads. Long, straight roads. We still have very many Roman roads in our country, don't we?
We do. In fact, is it the A1, which is the direct road from London to sort of somewhere up north, like Shropshire or something?
It goes in a straight line. Yes, it is Watling Street. Yeah. And also baths and bathing. Yeah. I don't think we were a particularly clean nation until along came the Romans and showed us how to build baths over hot springs and cold springs and that kind of thing.
No,
I think many aspects of their culture as well. And also, of course, Latin, the language, which is the foundation of so much of our own language.
Yeah, dead language now, though. Don't know why people bother.
It isn't, though. You know, if you don't know the meaning of a word, rather than just rush to the computer or the dictionary to look it up, you can very often work it out from its Latin and ancient Greek roots.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you're right. I didn't realise, because I employed a guy once who had a classics degree from Cambridge, okay? And he was quite a nice young fellow, wanted to be a boxing commentator, but unfortunately he was a drunk and he kept falling downstairs, literally, and things like that, you know, in his mid-20s.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, it was. It was unfortunate. And now he sort of disappeared. It was a terrible thing. He was only a young man. His father was a judge. He was only a young man, and he had a terrible drink problem, which he couldn't sort of face up to. He'd never admit that he'd had drinks and all that. But anyway, point of my story is he had a classics degree, same as our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And I said to him, you know, why do people still study Latin and Greek? And he told me, when you study the great works of Latin and Greek, like Ulysses, not Ulysses, what was it called?
Well, that was James Joyce, darling. He was Irish. Joyce.
Yes, that's right. But that was, Ulysses was based on the name of an equivalent Latin text, you know, called, I don't know, something else. Sorry about this. Non-specific.
Something else. Go and look it up.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But he said that every time a scholar, you know, reads and translates and interprets these great works by the great Roman and Greek authors, they come to different conclusions about what it's all about. I didn't realise that. They're not straightforward writings. They're all interpretive.
Well, it's like the Gospels in the Holy Bible, isn't it? You've got four Gospels, four differing accounts of historical happenings.
Right, really?
So you've got four versions of the truth, and some of those Gospels leave out details that others kind of labour on.
Yeah.
So I suppose you have a choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like any translation. I mean, you can read any novel in translation and you're not obviously getting what that author wrote in their original language, are you?
So
it's all an interpretation. It's a bit like, I used to sit next to a guy at the Daily Mail called Herbert Kretzmer, who's very famous now.
Right.
He was the TV critic in those days.
Herbert Kretzmer.
Yeah, he went on to write the English lyrics of Les Misérables, the fantastic musical.
Wow, yeah.
But he said, you know, I couldn't do a direct translation because I had to make it scan. It has to be verse. It has to rhyme.
Yeah.
And so he then had to also find English vernacular equivalents of various bits of, you know, sayings and lines and so on. So he had to literally turn it into something that was palatable to the English.
Right.
And therefore it lost its French roots.
Right.
And that's what all translators do, of course.
That right, that's fantastic. Of course, you're a lady of languages, aren't you? I've got to try a bit harder and learn a bit more French and Spanish. But the Romans I like very much indeed. You're absolutely right. They brought all sorts of things to our society. I, of course, come from Chester, which I think is the most famous Roman city in this country. Well, York is very famous, but Chester is. We've still got the city walls built by the Romans, and I'm all for them. What you said about us not being a clean nation, by the way, I read a book called The Pillars of the Earth by that great author who was married to a woman who became a Labour MP. That's a bit nonspecific, isn't it?
Yeah. Try a bit harder with that one, Mike.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'll remember his name in a minute. But anyway, he wrote this Pillars of the Earth, and it was set in the sort of Middle Ages, you know. And the attention to detail that he had in the life of people in those days was fantastic. And it revealed that the peasant workers on the land would only ever bathe twice a year, once at Michaelmas and once at some other time. And they just jumped into the local pond, you know what I mean? But that was it, twice a year. Because what happened after the Romans left came the Dark Ages. Did you know that we don't really know what happened in this country for 200 or 300 years after the Romans pushed off in about sort of 450 AD? We don't really know what's happened, but life went backwards at an amazing speed and we became uncivilized again.
Well, that's why they're called the Dark Ages, of course.
Is it? But, yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, not to get too nitty-gritty about these things, but if you don't have a shower for 3 or 4 days, say you've gone camping or something, you know, after the first 3 days, you're really aware of the fact that you haven't had a wash, right? Not to be too detailed about it. Yeah. But imagine what somebody would smell like after not having had a wash for a whole year.
I know, yes, I totally agree. I mean, he goes into some extraordinary detail where two people can be talking to each other and all of a sudden a worm can come out of the eye socket.
Oh, my God, that's gross.
People full of parasites and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, even more recently than that, if you go down into Docklands to Wapping, which you and I are very familiar with because that's where the Sun newspaper used to be, there's a load of riverside pubs there and they're fascinating, you know, full of history and all that kind of stuff. But the Victorian sort of labourers on the riverside, you know, the men who did all the hard work on the river, they would go in there overnight, and apparently it was such a repulsive smell because nobody ever washed or used deodorants that these days, the landlord of one of the pubs was telling me, you'd actually throw up because it was such a disgusting smell. But because everybody was exactly the same, nobody noticed.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And they wore, sort of a bit later down the line, didn't they? Had those massive wigs, which apparently whole families of mice would take up in.
Oh, my God. Oh, I think we'll get away from this.
I think we better, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of history turned into a less palatable truth. Now, tell me, if you can, the amazing story, please, of a person whose birthday is today, and that is Corley McCulkin. I mean, to talk about a boy who achieved worldwide fame and then actually just sort of disappeared is a bit of an understatement, isn't it?
It's a bit of a sad story, wasn't it? Because he ended up divorcing his parents and so on because they were exploiting his funds, let's say. He made a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I did have some dealings with this family because when I was living in Los Angeles with my first child, who's Mia.
Yes.
She was about 3, 4 at the time.
Yeah.
A crew came to the hotel, which was the Sunset Marquee, where I always used to stay because that's where all the rock stars stayed.
Right.
And they wanted her to do a screen test. And I kept saying, no, no, no. And the director rocked up a couple of days later and said, no, 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 we really think she's it. You know, we need her in the studio, please.
Who are you talking about?
Do a screen test. My little girl.
Oh, I see. Oh, she'd be screen tested.
Oh, yeah. And they wanted to cast her as Macaulay Culkin's little English cousin in another Home Alone sequel that it didn't go ahead in the end.
Yeah.
Thank God it didn't. But I wrote a couple of pieces in various papers about that experience, how I didn't sell my child to Hollywood, you know, and I was completely castigated for it.
Yes.
And she grew up to sort of give me a hard time about it. Why didn't you let me do that? Well, guess why? Yeah. You would now be a has-been. You would be a drug addict. You would have spent all the money. And it's not a very good idea to be a has-been before you're even 12, is it?
Well, so did you, as a mother, consciously think this would be a bad parenting decision to allow my little girl to become a world-famous cinema star at her age?
Yes. And I cited all kinds of examples, most of which I can't remember now, as to why one shouldn't do that. You know, you've only got to look at, Shirley Temple was a success story, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was,
So Judy Garland wasn't, Mickey Rooney wasn't.
No.
These people were addicted to drugs when they were still children.
Yeah, I know, yeah. That's amazing. That's an amazing story, that. And, you know, something I should imagine. Has your daughter forgiven you now?
No, she's really cross with me about it. So,
what, really?
Yeah, they don't know. You'd think they would know, wouldn't you, having me for a mother, what it's really like. But of course, Hollywood sells a dream. It sells an ideal that doesn't really exist. And Macaulay Culkin himself fell foul of that.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I thought the second Home Alone film was better than the first. You know, the one based in New York.
He was a little bit older by then, wasn't
that's
he?
Right.
He had that sort of charm about him. But yeah. Not the most successful adult, you'd have to say.
Oh, no, he's never done anything as an adult. He's 40 now. Last time I saw him was in an advert for the Meerkats. Do you remember? You don't watch a lot of telly, but the Meerkats are driving along, you know, in some big sort of motorhome thing in America, and one of them says to the other, whatever happened to Macaulay Culkin? And all of a sudden, there's a bloke thumbing a lift, you know, on this deserted desert road, and they stop, and Macaulay Culkin gets in. And that's the only time I've seen him in about the last 25 years. Because you're quite right, he was so famous in Home Alone. How do you translate that into anything else?
Well, you peak too soon, don't you? And that's the end of it.
Well, I suppose you're absolutely right. Talking about that and, you know, parenting and motherhood and all that kind of stuff, I don't suppose it's too widely connected. But I've been reading over the last couple of days that Carla Bruni, right, has admitted in a book she's writing that she slept with Mr. Sarkozy, the French leader, on her second date with him. And France has been a bit scandalised about this.
I think the question is, who didn't she sleep with?
Oh, you know,
she kind of worked her way through the rock stars, Eric Clapton and Mick Jagger and various others. She was a bit of a, there is a word for it. It begins with star and ends with you know the one I'm saying.
That doesn't sound like a bicycle to me.
Well, no, but I mean, God, I think people do these days, don't they? They jump into bed on the first date.
Whoa.
Whatever happened to courting? Whatever happened to getting to know one's date and finding out about them and not sort of going for the carnal jugular first?
Yes, well, I don't know. It says here, it's claimed that on her first trip with Sarkozy to her £2 million Riviera villa, she invited a trio of ex-boyfriends, which included Eric Clapton. They all had to sit at the same dinner table as her husband, sharing anecdotes about their relationships with her.
Oh, that's disgraceful, isn't it? I mean, what does she expect?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, talking about, you just mentioned, you know, courting and all that and marriage and all that kind of stuff. I came across a phenomenon in one of the journals I've been reading the last few days, and it's about women who get married and then immediately regret it within days. And this has all been prompted, of course, by a subject we've talked about before, and that's Elton John's blighted wedding to, what's her name? What was her name, Renata?
Renata Blauwel, who was a tape op at the studios where Elton was recording an album.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was revealed, wasn't it? And we've talked about this before, that within 3 days, Elton John had told her, I think it's a mistake, and 3 days into the honeymoon, asked her to leave. So that didn't work. But, you know, I've been looking at what a few women writers have been writing on this, and they say it's quite a common occurrence that for some unknown reason, women as early as halfway down the aisle suddenly realise they've done the wrong thing, they're in the wrong place, and they don't want to get married. I mean, have you come across that phenomenon amongst your friends?
Well, I suppose the most famous example was Princess Diana, who discovered on her wedding morning that her husband-to-be was in a railway siding the night before with his mistress in a train, and she knew about it, and she wanted to pull out. And all the courtiers and advisors insisted that the wedding must go ahead. People had flown in from all over the world. Yeah. The eyes of the world were watching this on television and so on, and she couldn't go through with it. But if you look at Diana's face in any of that footage from their wedding, you can tell how miserable she is.
On the day of their wedding, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, even on the balcony when the crowd are shouting, kiss her, kiss her, kiss her. She didn't want to be kissed, really, did she?
She didn't want to look at the guy. I mean, he'd been given a wedding present by his mistress that he was wearing that day.
The cufflinks.
Yes.
C and C, Charles and Camilla. By the way, that story you just touched upon about the railway siding, that was a brilliant Fleet Street story, because what happened was the Sunday Mirror got it, and it was their local correspondent somewhere in Wiltshire or something like that, you know, the West Country and all that. So the palace denied absolutely that Charles had spent the night in the siding with Diana on board. And they said, you mustn't print this story. You know, it's absolutely outrageous. It's completely untrue. Of course, what we now know years on was that Charles was in that railway carriage having sex with a woman as the springs were going up and down, but it wasn't Diana, it was Camilla. And the reason that the palace had to fervently deny it was because it would have been so obvious to Diana that she wasn't in that railway carriage, in that siding, so who was?
Can you imagine? Yeah. But going back to Elton, it's... not quite as it sounds in terms of timing. Yeah. So they got married down in Australia.
Right.
And then some months went past before they went down to the south of France to have their honeymoon.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Because he had work commitments. Mm. So during that time, they'd kind of discovered that it wasn't going to work. And by the time they went on the honeymoon, there were other people on the honeymoon with them, by the way.
Yeah.
So Bob Halley, who was Elton's old kind of right-hand man, and John Reed, his manager, who was his former lover as well. I mean, imagine that honeymoon. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
They were all there. And Elton, of course, by this time has realised that he can't commit to a heterosexual marriage because, guess what? He's gay.
Yeah, I know. It's... you're absolutely right about that, though. Fancy having your male lover with you on honeymoon. You know, be bad enough having a somebody else who you've had a relationship with in the past, but you're getting married to a woman and your male lover's there. Golly, doesn't bear thinking about, does it? Now then, what I was going to talk to you about was husband and wife working relationships, because am I the only one who feels that it's a tremendous strain on a marriage to also work with the woman that you live with and sleep with and dine with in the evenings? And I'm thinking, really, although I'm not pointing the finger at them at all, but Eamon Holmes and his wife, Ruthie, they work together, they live together. Eamon's a lovely guy. I've known Eamon for years, and I don't know Ruth too well, but they seem to have a pretty perfect relationship. But I don't know how it holds up under the, you know, the spotlight of 24-hour-a-day sort of unity.
Well, of course, they met on the job, as it were, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because Eamon was married to somebody else who was back in Ireland, and he met Ruth through his television work and eventually wound up leaving his first wife for Ruth, his wife now. I think it's more common than you think. I think quite a lot of couples do like doing everything together.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought around this, you know, who else could I think of? Richard and Judy.
Yeah.
Do you remember Esther Ranson and Des Wilcox?
Yes, I do, yeah.
And then, of course, Johnny and Fanny Craddock.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
May all your donuts turn out like Fanny's.
Yeah, I mean...
as they famously did. Yeah. Christine and Neil Hamilton were another prime example.
Yeah,
do you remember them?
They were. Yeah, no, you're right. It is quite more common than I thought. Richard and Judy was an interesting one, because I think Judy's 10 years older than Richard. And our offices once were near Waterloo Station. I'm talking about radio offices. And next door, there was a media block. And ITV made some shows in there. And every morning at about the same time as I was finishing my show, so the 1 o'clock and coming out, this woman came out of the building next door, and she had a walking stick and she was stooped. And it took me a few days to realise it was actually Judy. And she'd had a bit of a fall or something, and she looked awful. And I mentioned it to a mate of mine, you know, what we're like, you know, in gossip and like that. And blimey, the following day, the editor of that paper that my mate worked for had a photographer across the street hiding behind a bush and took a picture of Judy. And then, of course, they used the front page picture, you know, is Judy well and all that kind of stuff. And I felt so guilty because I didn't mean to actually drop her in it.
Yeah, well, if you don't want to drop anyone in it, never tell a story to a journalist,
exactly.
Right? It's just the way it is. But talking of the Hamiltons, do you remember that time when they were arrested? I think it was about 20 years ago. There was an alleged rape that they were supposed to have committed. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
And they had fantastic alibis and the case was dropped. It should never have been brought in the first place.
Yeah.
And it was some woman called Nadine Milroy Sloan. She got 3 years for perverting the course of justice. And guess who she was represented by?
Max Clifford.
There you go.
Really? Good God. I know, that was an amazing story, that, because it was so easy to prove that the Hamiltons weren't in the place that the incident's supposed to have taken place. They were hundreds of miles away, weren't they?
Exactly. I worked with them at the Express, actually, and I have to say I never really warmed to them, but I kind of got what they were trying to do.
Who? Christine and Hamilton?
Yeah, she was a very pushy person, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Do you remember she was all over television at one point on game shows and chat shows and things?
Yeah.
He always seemed to trail along in her wake.
Yeah, you know, he did. No, I totally agree. That's exactly what he did. The phenomenon about working together, as you quite rightly say, perhaps it's not as unusual, but actually in the same job, sitting next to each other on the couch, you know, because of course Fanny and they appeared on screen together. Desmond,
Fanny and Johnny, yeah. I actually remember them. Do you?
I do. Unfortunately, I remember her face. It was Craggy Craddock. But
Craggy Craddock. That's awful.
Well, it is, but she's dead now, so I'm sorry if her fans are objecting to that. But in the case of Desmond Wilcox, he was the producer, wasn't he, for what's her name?
Esther. Well, they were the most powerful couple at the BBC, weren't they? Do you remember when the whole Jimmy Savile crisis sort of broke latterly?
Yeah.
I mean, they would have known about it. And there was a rumour that Esther was so guilt-ridden that she founded Childline to kind of make up for it. For the fact that she'd known and had done nothing about it.
Is that right? I thought she...
That's what I heard.
I thought she had Childline before Jimmy Savile. Well, you could well be right. I mean, I know she's been campaigning for... Sure, she's been campaigning for all sorts of things for years. But, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, there's one thing that's really irritating me. We started off talking about the Beatles because of Brian Epstein and the lady who was at Radio 1. Do you know one thing that really gets my goat at the moment, Leslie Ann, is why these horrendous, murdering, brutal terrorists are called the Beatles?
I know, that's a horrible, horrible moniker that they adopted. I mean, you can't do much about that, can you? But
now, I'm looking at a headline now from this morning's paper. ISIS Beatles face US trial, but not the death penalty. The Beatles were everything that's good about life. These guys are everything that's bad about life. Please drop it.
I think the media are to blame here.
We are.
Because it's one thing for a group of people to call themselves something.
Yeah.
The media doesn't have to take them up on it and refer to them as that forevermore.
Yeah.
I think we should have, out of respect to the band and the remaining living members of that band, Paul and Ringo, we should have dropped it long ago.
I am absolutely and utterly surprised that Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr haven't got together and issued a statement requesting the media to drop that title, because it's horrendous to be associated with that sort of thing.
Well, that just fuels the fire, doesn't it? That would be another headline. And
well,
it associates Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr with terrorists. Mm. And that's the last thing they want. So probably their advisors have told them just shut up, ignore it.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. And talking about Ringo Starr, just to close today's podcast, this week his beautiful wife, Barbara Bach, was 66. And I have to say, she wears it well.
She's got to be older than 66.
No, 66.
Well, I dispute that. No offence to her, but she was at Shea Stadium.
Oh, yeah. Well, hang on. Maybe she's 76. Maybe got that.
She's got to be older, Mike, because she was at Shea Stadium for the famous concert, as was Linda McCartney when she was still Linda Eastman.
Really? Oh, right. I got that wrong.
They were New York gals, yeah. So she's got to be 76, I would say. But whatever she is, she's wearing it well.
Certainly. I never worked out how she became attracted to Ringo Starr. Ringo was, you know, in John Lennon's words, I think, he was the core of the Beatles, wasn't he? Didn't John always say Ringo was what it was all about?
Well, Ringo was the man on the street. He was everybody's way into the Beatles because the other three were unattainable, but Ringo looked like an ordinary guy, didn't he?
Yes, he did, yeah. No, I totally agree.
There was a Beatle for everyone, but Ringo was the most accessible.
Yeah, that's right. I totally agree. But, you know, he wasn't... I'm not calling Ringo dim because I don't think he's dim. Anybody who's done what he's done in life and succeeded as he's done is clearly a man of great substance and all that. But he's not a great intellect, whereas Barbara Bach always seemed to me to be, you know, the aloof and beautiful and, you know, highly intelligent actress. I wonder how they ever got together.
Well, she had that look about her, but I think that her background, her childhood, was really quite modest.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. Certainly Ringo's was, wasn't it? Spent a lot of time in hospital, I think, didn't he, as a kid?
Yeah, he did. Had very little education. Yeah, he was practically almost illiterate and innumerate when he left school.
God, really?
I know. He went very far, all the way to the top.
He certainly did, indeed, yeah. Right, okay, Leslie Hamill, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. And thank you to all the listeners for listening again. And on behalf of Leslie and myself, I want to say I hope we've once again passed the audition and we'll be back with you in a few days.
Ta-ra.
French in topless bus stop. French ministers have insisted topless sunbathing is a basic liberty after police told three women to cover up. The cops in Saint-Marie-le-Mer, 70 miles south of Montpellier, acted after a holidaymaker complained. Now, I tell you this, if I was on a beach and I saw a woman parading around topless, much to maybe your puzzlement, I would complain. I think it's offensive.
Why?
Well, because I feel embarrassed and I wouldn't know where to look, and I don't think that I should be looking at a semi-naked woman in a public place.
Let me ask you, do you go topless on the beach?
Yes, I do, but I don't have women's breasts. Well,
okay.
And I said to him, I said, you know, why do people still study Latin and Greek? And he told me, when you study the great works of Latin and Greek, like Ulysses.
Well, that was James Joyce, darling. He was Irish. Joyce.
Yes, that's right. But that was, Ulysses was based on the name of an equivalent Latin text, you know, called, I don't know, something else. Sorry about this. It's not specific. I do, unfortunately. I remember her face. It was Craggy Craddock. But
Craddy Craddock. Yeah. That's awful.
Well, it is, but she's dead now, so I'm sorry if, you know, her fans are objecting to that. Tell me, if you can, the amazing story, please, of a person whose birthday is today, and that is Corley McCulkin.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.